It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harbell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harbell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harbell & Collins, attorneys at law here on the Talk Station. And if you would like to join us, Mandy's ready to take your call, not only the 800 number, but these local numbers.
247-7282 and 353-4674.
Cecil Harbell and West Collins are in the studio, and good morning, guys.
Good morning, Ben.
Hey, Ben.
All right, what are we talking about today?
Well, Ben, the last few weeks we've talked about that word fiduciary mm-hmm. in the law. And just to review a bit, as you know, Ben, fiduciary is a person or entity, sometimes a corporation, but such a person or entity or corporation who holds funds or property for the benefit of another. And so a fiduciary would be an executor under a will. A mm-hmm. fiduciary would be a trustee under a trust, an agent under a durable power of attorney. A fiduciary could also be a guardian. These are all folks or entities, again, who hold property for the benefit of another.
Right.
And, of course, because of this, the nature of this relationship, there is a heightened duty that is imposed upon the fiduciary. You cannot, as we've said before on the program, as a fiduciary, make decisions similar to any decisions that you would make if it were your personal property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gosh, if it's your personal property, we pretty much can do with it as we please, can't we? We can
right.
sell our truck for whatever price we want to sell it at. We can sell our property. We can invest our monies however we choose to invest them or not invest them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Keep them in a pillowcase under the bed, as is sometimes said. Under the mattress. All of those kinds of things we can do as an individual, but when we are a fiduciary, there is a heightened duty that is imposed upon the fiduciary to act in a manner that is reasonable and consistent for the betterment of that property, the preservation, the growth, if you will, the non waste of any of that property for the benefit of the person that they're holding the property for.
Okay. All right. So where does that leave us in terms of, I know last week we were talking about some of the red flags and some of the things that happen when a fiduciary fails in their duties.
Right.
Right. We talked about that last week, Ben, and we kind of spun into, the litigation aspect of, breach of fiduciary duty. Toward the end of the program, we talked about the fact that if, there's an allegation of breach of fiduciary duty, and there is, in fact, a fiduciary relationship that's proven through the case, then the law in North Carolina shifts that burden to the fiduciary so as to basically put the burden on them to show that they did not breach whatever that duty may be,
mm-hmm.
which is important, for us attorneys, because when we're talking about plaintiff-defendant, the plaintiff usually has the burden of proof. To prove there was a breach of contract or there was negligence or whatever the issue might be. But this puts the shoe on the other foot when you're talking about a breach of fiduciary duty, because the fiduciary, the power of attorney, the trustee, the executor would be in the position of a defendant in that case. But if the mm-hmm. proper allegations are made with regard to breach of fiduciary duty, then the burden then falls squarely on the shoulders of that defendant to prove that they did not breach the fiduciary duty. For example, I had the authority of the principal to take $10,000 out of the account, and
right.
I'm going to prove that I did, that kind of thing. It's important burden shifting as it relates to these cases. Now, we did talk about that last week, and one of the things we want to, spin into today to talk a little bit more about, which is similar to breach of fiduciary duty, but also different is, and we've talked about in the program before, is, will caveats.
Mm-hmm.
Because, when you talk about breach of fiduciary duty, you're talking about someone who has been put in that position as a fiduciary and has that heightened duty to act for the benefit of the principal in their best interest. But when you're talking about a will caveat, you know, you may have someone out there who is subjecting undue influence on someone to have them sign a will, who may be, you know, taking someone a document to have them sign as a will, who may be in diminished capacity and not have the capacity to enter a will.
Right.
But it's not really a breach of fiduciary duty, and it's not really a plaintiff versus defendant kind of action we deal with when we challenge a will that's been accepted into probate. It's called a will caveat, and that's what's called an in rem proceeding. This is getting technical into the legal world here, but in rem,
right.
I-N, then R-E-M, proceeding. And what that means is the thing, in rem, is the will, is the script. So North Carolina has a procedure that's set forth, as most states do, in dealing with a particular challenge, you know, to a will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the event that, let's say, someone believes that a will that's been accepted into probate is not really the will of the decedent because of undue influence by someone, mm-hmm. someone, you know, asserting their own influence upon the person who signed the will, or lack of capacity, let's say that the person didn't have the requisite capacity to understand who his family members were, what his assets were, how the assets would pass through the will, how the will would operate, or maybe even there was a technical issue with the will, such as maybe it doesn't have the two witnesses as are required in North Carolina. Then a will caveat is filed, and all parties who would be interested in that, which would be anyone who has a potential benefit received from the estate, any heirs of the decedent would be given notice of this, and then they have the right to come to court and to align and to take a position as to whether we're going to challenge this will on one hand, or we're going to take the position that, no, we're not going to challenge this will. We think that this is his last will and testament, or her last will and testament, or take a neutral position, meaning I'm not going to get in this litigation at all.
So a will caveat, and I want to make the distinction here, an in rem proceeding there is about challenging the will on its face. It is wrong in how it's structured.
Well, it's not just on, when you say on its face, you know, what that means to us attorneys is that, you know, you're looking at the four corners of the document to make sure
right.
that it meets the requisites of a will, the legal requisites. That could be part of it. There could be a technical problem with the document itself. But it also is, we're going to file this action, and we're going to put on evidence and prove our case to show that the person who purportedly signed this will didn't have the capacity to sign it.
Uh-huh.
We're probably going to do that through medical records and testimony of people who knew how the person was doing and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be either one. We're going to show that this person, at the time that the will was signed, was under the undue influence of, for example, the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's say we've got the case that we've all heard of, you know, the 90-year-old has two children who he loves dearly, but the two children live out of state, and someone's been taking care of him, this caregiver.
Right.
But lo and behold, 10 days before he dies, he signs a new will, leaving everything to the caregiver.
And
sounds
it
a
may
little,
not be
a, sounds a little suspect, right?
Yeah, it may right. not be a question of mental acuity,
right.
Just of undue influence.
Yeah, or it could be both.
Right.
Because, you know, as we all know and would assume, you know, individuals of advanced age and diminished capacity are usually more susceptible to undue influence.
Right.
I mean, is a 50-year-old
yes.
with perfectly health going to be more or less likely to be subjected to and affected by undue influence as compared to a 90-year-old who has some dementia presentation?
Then basically, one goes back to, a lawyer will go back to law school, so to speak, and begin to analyze the totality of the circumstances as well as the documentation, which then becomes known as the last will and testament. Mm-hmm. There is, of course, a body of law that mentions that the testator in the state of North Carolina must be a sound mind, must know the nature of their estate, must know who their beneficiaries happen to be. Okay, this is sometimes known as, you know, knowing the bounty of one's estate, the nature of it, as well as whose one's beneficiaries happen to be. Now, these then are coupled with the document itself, that it must be the signature of the testator, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. then, of course, a written will. It's to then be witnessed by at least two witnesses in the state of North Carolina. Most lawyers will get three witnesses. Most lawyers will, of course, put those signatures all under notary. The requirement that it be under notary is not a legal requirement. It makes the probate of that will more efficient, because the witnesses don't have to be located, but a will will not fail, if you mm-hmm. will, for lack of a notarization. Okay. But we look at all of these circumstances, and any one significant failure of these circumstances would potentially lead a client and lead their lawyer to advise a will caveat. For instance, I mean, isn't it peculiar for a person to have three children and to then, you know, not include maybe right. one of the children, or right. maybe not include any of the children, mm-hmm. And yet make no mention in the will that this person is particularly excluding the children, or is excluding this one child, and what the circumstances might be. And of course, we all know, outside circumstances. For instance, maybe that child is not included in the will, and the entire family knows that that child is mm-hmm. not included in the will because that child is handicapped and has been on, right. you know, government benefits, and therefore, if they were to include an inheritance, if they were to receive an inheritance, they would be disqualified now from the assistance that they receive. Maybe they've been institutionalized since for a long, mm-hmm. long time in a disability facility. Well, then obviously there are reasons outside the scope of the will why that child would not be included. But
all right,
but to answer your question, it's a totality of circumstances.
Okay, take a short break. We'll come back with more talking about will caveats and also about fiduciary duties as well. Here, your questions are welcome at 800-818-2255. And welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, here on the Talk Station. They're online at harvellandcollins.com. And if you'd like to call in with a question, Mandy will take your call right now.
Call me at 800-818-2255 or use one of our local numbers, 247-7282 or 353-4674.
And Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell are with us here today. We're talking about the duties of a fiduciary and also will caveat. If somebody has, if you believe that someone has failed in their duty and you are filing a caveat, does that stop things? Does that, like, put a halt to the proceedings?
Yeah, it does, Ben. You know, like we talked about at the beginning of the program, you know, really when you're talking about a breach of fiduciary duty claim itself, if you're just filing a breach of fiduciary duty claim, you know, in many cases, that in and of itself is not going to freeze the activities of the fiduciary unless mm-hmm. you get an injunction of some sort from the court, like a preliminary injunction. But when you're talking about filing a caveat, the caveat has a very specific statute. And just to go back for our listeners, a caveat is a challenge to a will. There's a specific statute that allows the clerk of court to immediately enter an order freezing all activity in the estate other than, like, collecting debts and those type things, but certainly not dispersing money. And so that does freeze things. A couple other things that I would mention, as Cecil was referring to just a moment ago, he was talking about the requisites of a will. What he was referring to was an attested will, where we have to have two witnesses, you know, keep in mind there are other kinds of wills. We just don't see them very often, like a holographic will, Ben.
Right.
Would be, you know,
handwritten,
all in the handwriting of the testator, signed by the testator, and found with the important documents of the testator. And in that particular situation, we would have to have witnesses come forward by affidavit or come and testify as to the valid or the validity of the handwriting on the document that it was, in fact, the deceased. So there are different kinds of wills, but, you know, this day and time, 95-99% of the wills we see, of course, would be the attested type where there would be two witnesses. So other things that you take into consideration when filing a caveat, Ben, you know, are certainly going to be, just like in any litigation, you don't do it casually because there could be negative repercussions. Obviously, there's expense related to filing a caveat, and there is a statute that would allow the Superior Court to enter an order assessing attorney's fees on both sides to, let's say, someone who brought a caveat without some merit. You have to have some probable cause to bring it. You can't just not like what the will says. I mean, you have to have some basis, such as capacity issues or undue influence issues, or if we think it's a fraudulent document, those type things.
So does that preclude if someone is found to not have those issues, can you still file against a fiduciary claiming a breach of responsibility?
Yes, and in many cases, you know, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about breach of fiduciary duty and then caveat. But in many cases, a breach of fiduciary duty case oftentimes sounds in fraud. Mm-hmm. Meaning there's some kind of fraudulent activity going on. Well, as I mentioned last week, you know, when we're dealing with fraud, by the very nature of fraud, if you're a decent fraudster, you're probably not going to do it in the open.
Right.
If you follow what I'm saying, you're going to do it surreptitiously. You're going to, you know, operate in a private way. So it could be that there has been, let's say, an inquiry about the activities of the trustee or the executor or whomever this fiduciary is, and their suspicion about malfeasance, about misusing assets of the estate or the trust. But we may not have absolute evidence of that, and it could be that we bring an action for breach of fiduciary duty and fraud somewhat precipitated by the fact that the trustee or their executor is not providing documentation to show how she or he has acted. And that would be, you know, sufficient grounds, because normally someone who is operating, you know, above board is going to be transparent and provide whatever documentation, bank records, whatever it would be, you know, to answer the questions of, let's say, the interested beneficiary who thinks that there's some wrongdoing going on.
Okay. All right. We have a question for us before we take a break. Let's talk to Miles in Havelock now. Hi, Miles.
Hi, yeah. My question, again, I called the other day. You asked me to call back on Tuesday morning. You drive through the country and you see these little cemetery plots on fields. What happens to that when the land is sold and there's no longer any descendants to take care of that? Do the new owners have a requirement to take care of that, or has that been deeded to the county or something?
Well, I can tell you, Miles, there's many statutes that protect and govern these cemeteries, many of them historic in nature, you know, on the hill, if you will, under the oak tree, out on family farms. There are statutes in the state of North Carolina that protect these particular cemeteries.
Okay.
And so in other words, a new owner would take the property subject to the cemetery and subject to all of the statutes that keep you from being able to destroy that cemetery or any
limit access.
Or limit access, things of that nature.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Miles. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more from Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. You can go online to find out more about Harvell and Collins at harvellandcollins.com. Back with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law here on the talk station. We have a couple of minutes left to talk about these things. Now, we mentioned about the fiduciary duties and then also about the will caveat. If you file a will caveat and it stops all the proceedings or the distribution of funds and proceeds, seems like that would bring somebody to the negotiating table pretty quickly.
Yeah, no kidding. It does sometimes. And, you know, we have to be careful when we file caveats, when we're considering to file a caveat, because we certainly don't want the propounder of the will, the person who's defending against the caveat, to use estate assets necessarily to defend against the caveat, that could very well defeat, you know, what we're fighting over.
Right.
So that's part of the purpose for this statute, to freeze everything. I mean, it's pretty logical as well. If you're going to bring a caveat because you believe that the will is not the will, well, it doesn't make any sense to continue to proceed with the probate of the estate through this document that might be set aside.
One last thing to say, Ben, as we conclude today, is a person has 3 years from the date in which the will is admitted to probate, and the executor qualifies to bring a caveat action. So there's a 3-year statute of limitations. It does not run from the date of